This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
How many here from New Jersey? I figured you guys were packing this crowd. Anyway, I'm Bradley Graham. I'm the co-owner of Politics and Prose, along with my wife, Lisa Muscatine. And on behalf of the entire PNP staff and everyone here at Six and I, welcome. You know, we at Politics and Prose really enjoy hosting author talks in this marvelous venue. It's so great that the staff here has worked so hard and so successfully over the past decade to turn this place into such a vibrant center for the cultural life in Washington. So this is a sold-out event. Not many politicians in Washington these days could draw a sold-out crowd for a book talk. And I should note that it sold out even before Cory Booker's name started popping up in articles speculating about who President Obama might nominate for the Supreme Court. In the 18 years he's been in politics, first as a Newark city councilor, then mayor, and now a member of Congress, Senator Booker has attracted attention well beyond New Jersey for doing the unusual, the unconventional, and sometimes the unthinkable. From moving into a housing project after his mayoral election to helping constituents dig their cars out during snowstorms and retrieve their cats from trees, to taking on an entrenched and corrupt local political establishment, he's established a reputation as a reform-minded politician with boundless energy and a can-do attitude. This is not altogether surprising, given his history as a high achiever. Before entering politics, he was an All-America tight end at Stanford, a Rhodes Scholar, and a graduate of Yale Law School. Once in politics, he also was one of the first and most effective elected officials to understand the civic power of social media, using it to connect with his constituents and create an ongoing 24/7 dialogue about matters in the community. And he didn't stop this practice once he got to Capitol Hill, where he's affectionately known as the tweet god of the Senate. With his new book, his first, he's chosen to reveal more about himself, to go beyond his official resume filled with its public and professional achievements, and write about his journey so far, some of the people who've shaped him, and some of the hard lessons learned along the way. The title of the book, United, Thoughts on Finding Common Ground and Advancing the Common Good, might sound rather at odds with the pervasive disunity, paralysis, and cynicism in Washington nowadays. But that's the point. Senator Booker's essential message argues against the prevailing mood and for a new civic discourse based on empathy, solidarity, and responsibility to address the nation's pressing problems. Now, he's been very frank in acknowledging this book was harder to write than he had expected. He hadn't written anything this long before, and he put many hours into the project. And even so, there were times when he got stuck, wanted to yell, pound his desk. But he made it through, and the result is a very personal story. To help him talk about it this evening will be another rising star in the Democratic Party, Julian Castro, who has been Secretary of Housing and Urban Development for the past couple of years, and before that was himself a mayor of his native San Antonio. So you've had a little farther to come than the ones from New Jersey. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Cory Booker and Julian Castro.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, Cory, you sold the place out. Congratulations. First of all, thank you all very much for having us this evening. I want to thank Bradley and everyone at Politics and Prose and the folks here at Sixth and I for a wonderful venue. And I want to congratulate you on completing this book. And I guess start by asking you, first of all, tell us a little bit about why you chose this title, United.
So, first of all, I just want to say thank everybody for being here. But in particular, I want to thank Secretary Castro. This is not quite in the job description that the president gave him when he started, but he is showing a generosity to an old friend. Secretary Castro and I met each other when we were both mayors of American cities. And it was then that we actually share a little bit of a similar background. We both went to the same college. He got in because of his grades and SAT scores. I got in because of my 4.0 and 1600, 4.0 yards per carry, 1600 receiving yards.
Do we have any Stanford folks here tonight?
Right. Not quite as loud as the Jersey folks. There's actually only four Jersey people here, but we make a lot of noise. Secretary Castro is really one of those people who has exhibited in his career extraordinary competence, not just at the federal level, but being a mayor of a big city in America is the hardest job, in my opinion, in all of politics. But what I like about Secretary Castro, especially at this time that we're watching the debates in Washington, is that he exhibits this idea that you don't have to be mean to be strong. You don't have to be cruel to be tough. He's a real gentleman, and I think what was said in that generous introduction is true. I think that America is going to be seeing greater and greater levels of service for him in the future. So please give another round of applause. Thank you. And so I will answer his question, but I have to just say one thing that I think is rather obvious, that Secretary Castro would be a far more successful person if he shaved his head. I'm so happy he agreed to do this. And I just really, when I was campaigning for Senate, was surprised getting out of Newark now. I love my state, and I come from the northern part of my state. But now visiting all 21 counties as I campaigned, whether it was rural counties, suburban counties, or urban counties, everybody in every group meeting, from small house parties to large events, seemed to be lamenting the fact that our country was seeing bigger and bigger divisions between us. And they wanted to know how we could get things done, how we could do big things now, but when we seem to be stuck and mired in more exaggerated differences. And so I felt like that one of the themes in my life really has been with parents and mentors in Harrington Park, New Jersey, and incredible teachers. I always say I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD in the streets of Newark with some of the heroes that I talk about in the book. It just seemed to be everybody was taking a different approach at this theme, that we as Americans need each other far more than we realize, that we have one destiny, and that they were exhibiting to me what I think real patriotism is. And too often we reduce patriotism to a flag pin, or we use it as a cudgel or sword to condemn somebody else and say how much more patriotic I am. But patriotism, if you think about it, is love of country, and you can't have love of America if you don't love Americans. So I think the greatest patriots are those people that see in other Americans themselves or their greatest hopes or an understanding that we need each other. And that's what I really wanted to write a book about, that patriotic ideal.
Wonderful. And I think you're right. You capture the sense of this time. People seem to be yearning for that message and for folks who embody it, and you certainly do and have in your public service. We have these images in our head, for instance, of the moon landing or troops raising the flag on Iwo Jima or the fireside chats. It seems like over the years it's become harder to summon a national identity. You have quite a perch dealing, as you do, with national and international issues. How do you think, based on your experience and what you talk about in the book, how do you believe that we can begin to kind of rekindle that in our body politic?
So I think we need to celebrate those ideals. You know, the founding of our country, the Declaration of Independence, was really, if you read the document and know our history, it's more of a declaration of interdependence. The last part of that Declaration of Independence is about, I need you. It says, I pledge to you my fellow countrymen, woman, I pledge to you my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor. And so my father, who died 6 days before I was elected to become a United States Senator, really shook me. And a lot of the book, as you've seen, is struggling with this. One of the chapters that was hardest to write was called My Father's Son, which is about me and my father and another young man who was somebody I felt had so much love for, who ends up getting murdered in the city, and then me tracking down his dad and looking at these relationships. But my father really tried to show me as a boy, because you imagine this, and many of you all know this, that you have had, all of us have poverty in our background somewhere, and many of us are first-generation middle class. Many of us are struggling ourselves, but I was first-generation middle class. So my dad was born poor, and if he was here right now, he would heckle me from the back of the synagogue and say, "Boy, don't tell those people I was poor. tell them the truth. I was just P-O. I couldn't afford the other two letters." And he was born to a single mother, which my dad, and this is, again, 100% true. I'd come down from telling people, yeah, my dad was born poor and to a single mom. And he'd walk off and he'd go, "Boy, why'd you tell those people I was a bastard?" I said, "Come on now." And my dad had this humor and wit that he tried to use to soften the hurt of his birth and his childhood, back when these things had a horrible stigma, and it was in the middle of Jim Crow South. And I would hear the stories about these, how he broke out, how did he break out of poverty, that now I know from going back that this poverty went all the way back into slavery. And my father would look at me in a different environment and see me walking around. I don't care, anybody here, if you have kids, nobody had more 18-year-old swagger than I did, a teenage swagger you've never seen before. And I'd be walking around this really nice home in suburban New Jersey, and he would say, "Boy, don't you dare walk around this house like you hit a triple. You were born on third base." And his point to me really was that you think you may have got here because of your hard work, but let me tell you the truth, that I, as hard as my father had incredible discipline and hard work, and I know you come from, I know stories about your mother, the incredible work ethic of our parents, but my dad was always telling me that he got to where he is today because of a conspiracy of love, of people who were not his blood relatives, but when his mama couldn't take care of him, they were there to take care of him. When he couldn't afford college, it was, and didn't even think about going to college, it was people that turned around his destiny in a church that put dollars in a collection plate so he could afford that first semester's tuition. I don't know what the ROI was on those acts of kindness. Then in college, both my parents would not let me forget what was going on when they were in college in the civil rights movement. I was a young man. I got invited to speak as mayor to my mom's college on her 50th reunion. And I, again, walked in with swagger. I sat at this big banquet table. They were honoring me. And then my mom comes over to me, and I don't know what it is about mothers that they have the ability, no matter how old their children are, to make them feel like they're 12. but I'm the mayor of Newark, you know, and my mom comes over and, "Get up, get up." I'm like, "What?" She starts pulling me, "Get up, boy, get up." And I'm like, "Mom, I'm the mayor." And she starts taking me around to tables and saying, "You need to meet this person. This is the person that led our student boycotts and was threatened to be expelled from school for doing it. This is the person that led voter registration drives when people were being killed, Goodman, Cheney, Schwerner, for doing so." It was almost like she was saying, "Pay attention. These people who are not your blood relatives fought for you, struggled for you." And even to get my parents' first job right here in D.C., I don't care if you're a woman, if you're Irish, most of us, there was a time when corporate America wouldn't hire you. But it was activists in the later 60s that opened up doors for my parents. My dad was the first African-American salesman hired in the greater Virginia region. And then my parents would continue, even moving into Harrington Park, which is one of the more stunning stories there. And I went back to interview people at the time. But they, northern New Jersey, Bergen County, they wouldn't sell homes to black people in most of the 70 counties. And my parents had to get a white couple, after being steered away from the Fair Housing Council, to pose as them to buy the house and close it. And on the day of the closing, when the white couple didn't show up and my dad and a volunteer lawyer did, the lawyer was attacked by the real estate agent. A dog was sicked on my father. And I'll tell you that every time my dad tells that story, the dog got bigger. but But this was me now growing up, as my father called us, four raisins in a tub of sweet vanilla ice cream in Harrington Park, New Jersey. And he'd be like, you didn't earn this. This was paid for you by the struggles of other people. And you can't pay it back, but you've got to pay it forward. And the way you do that is by breaking out of your circles of privilege and connecting with other humans who are part of your destiny and your future. And so, you know, just to conclude, you know, we in this nation have so many lines that constrict us from seeing each other, from loving each other, from doing acts of courageous empathy. But the causes of our country are no less urgent than they were in my parents' generation. In fact, as one of the most painful things that I write, my dad ever said to me after horrific murder for me of another young boy, my father lamented to me that I fear that a child born poor in a segregated environment to a single mom would be better off if they were born in 1936 than born under those circumstances today, because he knew the data. One out of three young black men born in America is going to go to prison. The leading cause of death for young black men is murder. And it was really like he was condemning my generation. He didn't mean it that way. And I wanted to scream to him. I was in so much pain from the murder. I wanted to scream from him and say some bold declaration, not on my watch. But at that point, I was too down, too broken to even meek out a response to him. And so I think that we as collectively, as a community, as a nation, as you said so nobly, which is, you know, we used to do great things, but we're stuck in this idea that, you know, rugged individualism somehow got us to where we are, self-reliance. I'm sorry, rugged individualism didn't get us to the moon. Yeah. It didn't map the human genome. It didn't build our highways, roads, and bridges. It's been our ability to do great things. It's always come from our great love and cooperation with each other.
Certainly. And, you know, I thought that that you wrote very movingly about your family and also humorously at the beginning about going on Henry Louis Gates' show, Finding Your Roots, and maybe you could tell us just briefly about that, because you said you didn't actually know much, you know, beyond your grandparents before then, and what that experience was like finding out about your genealogy.
Well, it's a chapter really about power, and Alice Walker said it clearly: the most common way we give up our power is not realizing we have it in the first place. And as nice as it might be to sit here on a stage with a secretary in the president's cabinet and a senator, the greatest heroes we often exalt in our history, if you think about it, didn't need a title or a position. And so this chapter starts off in a very candid way. Where the first line is, I hate Henry Louis Gates. I just seem to have, and this is a book where I really talk about getting my comeuppance. And Henry Louis Gates, if you know him, he's people see him as his vaunted Harvard professor. He's a rascally guy. He's a great sense of humor, incredibly charming. And so he calls me up, and he knows how to stroke a politician's ego. He's like, Corey, I've got this great opportunity for you, this TV show, Finding Your Roots. I'm like, I know it. And I'm thinking maybe he's inviting me to a premiere with, you know, to see Oprah's story or Chris Rock's story. And he's like, no, I want you to be in it. Me, yes, you. And I'm all excited. He goes, you're an up-and-comer, and I'm going to pair you with another politician. And he starts getting me all excited about it. And then I say, okay, well, who are you pairing me with? And I'm thinking he's going to pair me with another peer of mine like you. And he goes, no, I'm going to pair you with John Lewis. And I'm like, I just got quiet. I'm just like, that's like pairing Superman with Jimmy Olsen, for crying out loud. And so they have to do the beginning of the show. And if you've watched the PBS special, they do bios, just like they did of me and you to introduce us. But this is so unfair, because John Lewis's bio effectively goes like this. John Lewis, hero of the civil rights movement. Standing on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, staring down with peace and love in his heart, Alabama state troopers. There's tear gas. There's billy clubs. He literally gets beaten and bleeds the southern soil red for freedom. And then...
You might have a future in narration
thank
there.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And then it's a Saturday Night Live. I want to replace Don Pardo. But then they go to me. Same splendiferous voice. Cory Booker. Riding his big wheel in suburban affluent New Jersey. Takes a turn too hard, falls off, skins his knee. He bleeds the northern soil red for big wheel riders everywhere.
And so that's how this thing starts. And so it's like, and so the powerful thing for me is this is a chapter where I discover, as we all would, you know, Skip Gates says this in humor to me, as he goes, you know, folk in this country think they know their histories, and they don't. First of all, if you look at black people, he goes, no matter what shade skin color, most black Americans, unless they were immigrated right from Africa, have white blood in them. And it didn't get there by some accident. There was a whole lot of love going on. Sometimes, unfortunately, not. But so he traces my history back to dead ends in my family. Like, we didn't know who my grandfather's father was. He was clearly biracial. It was a stigma to be so-called illegitimate child, and he clearly was shades lighter than his siblings and his mother. And Gates solves this mystery by testing people's swabbing cheeks and finds this white family that had no clue. Imagine saying, excuse me, can I test your DNA? Okay, and they swab it. You are a direct match. You have a black dude in New Jersey. This is in Louisiana that you're related to. And they find my mom's first cousin. My mom and this man that they found has shared the same grandfather. And so it's this powerful realization that we're all far more, in fact, my history, which Henry Luce Gates said, I hit the lottery, because most African Americans, one of the great crimes of American history is that you're robbed of knowing your lineage. You can't trace back beyond the 1870 census, because they weren't even tracking African Americans. But he was able to pierce it through because of family members who were considered property, were caught up in court cases. So he basically concludes that, look, you are the direct descendant of a Confederate soldier, white Confederate soldier. You're the direct descendant of an white Alabama militiaman who killed Native Americans, kicked them off their lands. But hey, you're also a direct descendant of slaves, as well as slave owners. You're a direct descendant of Native Americans. It was an amazing tapestry and made me feel like I walk past people every day and we might be blood. But what was even more important than that for me in this discovery was that we're all connected even deeper by spirit. And that's where the John Lewis story took a turn that I didn't know when I started writing the chapter. It just came from interviewing people. And so I went back to test stories, because we all have our family stories, but do we ever stop and do it like a reporter should, mm-hmm. and go back and find the truth? And being that I'm in politics now, and I'm seeing the climate out there, anything I talk about, I better have second and third ways of backing it up. So I go back and find the lawyers, try to track down the lawyers to help my family move in. And I found this lawyer, Arthur Lessman, who first got my parents' case file. And I said to him, he's in his 80s now, and I said, sir, I'm Cory Booker. And he goes, I know who you are. And I said, you took the case file of my family when we moved in. I remember it clearly. I go, why did you do that? And he says, well, I remember it was a Monday. And I'm like, you're 84 years old. I can't remember the what I had for lunch yesterday. And he's like, Cory, it was a Monday. I go, well, why do you remember it was a Monday? And he said, because I came to work that Monday and told my partner, Leo, that we had to go to Alabama. We were two struggling lawyers. They were starting the law firm. And I said, why did you say you have to go to Alabama? Because it was the Monday after Bloody Sunday. And I saw these people on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and they so moved me, I said, well, what am I doing to make this country better? And then we looked at each other and almost laughed, because we couldn't afford a day of closing our office, not to mention what it would take. So we decided to start calling around and finding civil rights organizations that might need our help nearby. And next thing you know, they connect with the Fair Housing Council of New Jersey, and a little while later, they get the case file carrying Carolyn Booker. And so just think about that. One, I don't know if those marchers knew that the instant that they stood on that bridge, they were triggering a chain of events through one good deed that affected generations yet unborn. I am where I am today because Arthur Lessman was inspired by some people on a bridge. And so we all have this tremendous power. My father and mother taught me this thing that as important as you think your professional mission is, or the big speech, the big campaign, the truth of the matter is the biggest thing we can do in any day is often a small act of kindness and decency and love to another person.
And when we have a society that loses that power of human touch, that power of extraordinary kindness, we miss out on our opportunities to make our nation's very ideals real for everyone. Because no matter what you write in the Constitution, which I find myself reading again this week because of the Supreme Court controversy, it's clear to me that those words and those ideals mean nothing based on what was written explicitly. They're nothing without a spirit of a people that tries to live those values, not hope other people represent them in Congress, but live those values themselves every single day. And that when we pledge allegiance to the flag and swear an oath that says that we'll be a nation of liberty and justice for all, we may not be able to solve all the injustices in the world, but we can't allow our inability to do everything to undermine our determination to do something every day to manifest our love, our patriotism, our love for one another in this country.
Wonderful. Very well said. And I know we're going to... We want to get to audience questions, so I'm going to ask a question, and then we'll get to audience questions. If folks want to line up at either of the microphones if you have a question, you're getting your two-minute warning.
And I just want to say, I mean, and I know you want to, how about I get a question? This is so unfair. I mean,
I didn't write a book, man.
But I should get some kind of privilege because I control your budget. that was not a threat. but, I mean, you and I are, you're Latino, I'm African American, you grew up in Texas, I grew up in the vastly superior state of New Jersey.
We probably have some Texans in the audience here.
this guy's got a shirt, he ran up here just to show
you. There you go, UT.
Oh my gosh. But the crazy thing about the stories that I, some, the stories early in the book, because the later in the book is about other people, but is that how familiar they are for even someone who is from a different culture in our country.
Sure.
And I know a bit about your life and your story and yourself and your extraordinary brother, but you grew up with that same kind of amazing family values that are really a reflection of American values, right?
Yeah, I was telling Corey, we talked before this, that one of the things I could easily identify with was the people that you talked about, folks like Virginia Jones. You have a whole chapter on Miss Virginia Jones, who was a tenant, a resident leader in the Brick Towers, and just the enormous privilege that it is to be in public service. And more than that, I think to be in public service at a young age when you have a lot of idealism and energy and you want to change the world, and then you meet these folks who have seen a lot and who give you wisdom and also remind you of why you're in public service in the first place. My experience was a little bit different, of course, but I saw a lot of similarities there. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, you graduated from Stanford, Rhodes Scholar, then you went to Yale Law School, who some folks suggest is the best law school in the United States. Some people say Harvard, but... you could have gone to New York, could have made a lot more money. I'm sure you had corporate law firms beating down your door. Just share with us why you decided to go and work with public housing residents in Newark, New Jersey. And now, 15, 20 years later, looking back on that, and, in your heart, as you go forward, what do you take from the people that you met there and the experiences that you had? What stays with you most of all?
Well, I mean, so going from Yale Law School to Newark, please let's not be confused. I went there with a hell of a lot of ambition, and I went there thinking, having a high esteem of myself. And, I was driven because of the way I was raised, as I said earlier, because I wanted to make contributions. But the powerful thing about, I often joke that I decided to follow the calling of a great prophet, not quite as much as the ones that are in behind me, like Moses. But this is the great American prophet, Chris Rock, who said, why is it often the most violent street in many cities, named after the man that stood for nonviolence? I moved on to Martin Luther King Boulevard in Newark, which actually is a great street even in the mid-90s, but the south end of it was and I had worked in inner cities from East Harlem to East Palo Alto. This was overrun with drug dealing and violence, and I moved next to in a boarding house next to an abandoned building that was being used for drugs. And even my very first moments moving into the city, carrying my stuff in with my best friend from fourth grade, we come back to my car and my belongings have been stolen. Yep. And I'm looking across the street at guys who I'm thinking are involved in the drug trade, who are sort of looking at me, and I'm projecting in a menacing way. And didn't call the police, didn't the cop, just keep moving. And then in those first weeks, I was very intimidated by the street. And so there's a wonderful thing I know about from a teacher, and it's an idea of faith, that, you know, faith is knowing that when you come to the end of all the light you know and you're about to step into the darkness, that one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to find solid ground underneath you, or the universe will send you people who will teach you how to fly. And so I got to Martin Luther King Boulevard, and this is the extraordinary thing about the experience of writing this book, was that I thought I knew all the things to know about this story, but and it's a story I told on my 10 years later on my inauguration. I moved in 96, got elected mayor in 2006, but I met this woman who was a tenant president. People said, you had to go to this woman. And so I went with a healthy ego, knock on her door. I'm Cory Booker from Yale Law School. I was like John Wayne. I'm here to help you, Philly. And I very high esteem of myself, and I was very surprised that she didn't greet me as if I was the great liberator that I thought I was. And she was an elderly woman, tough, gruff, seemed like she had no patience for me. She let me sit down. She would talk to me. She wouldn't even look me in the eye. The phone kept ringing. She'd pick it up and talk, yell out, bark out, hang. And so I felt like suddenly I was having to try to like convince her that I had something worthy to offer. And it was like an interview. And again, in my arrogance, I'm like, I don't fail interviews, but I'm failing this one. And one of the early things she did is take me downstairs through the project lobby, through the courtyard, past the line of men. And then she says to me, basically, tell me what you see on this street. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, describe what you see in a very impatient manner. So I started in. I see the projects. I see the abandoned building. And then she just seemed to get disgusted with me or frustrated. And she finally said, you can't help me. And she wheels around and starts storming away. And I chase after her, grab her very respectfully. and I say, what are you talking about? And she looks at me hard. And again, she's 5 foot and a smidge, and I'm 6'3". But at this point, she looks like she's looking down on me. And she says, boy, you need to understand something. That the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of these people who only sees problems, darkness, and despair, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of these stubborn people who every time you open your eyes, you see hope, possibility, you see love, you see the face of God, then you can be someone who helps me. And she walks away, sort of leaving me looking at my feet, thinking to myself, okay, grasshopper, thus endeth the lesson. And so you asked me what I learned. This, I went back to her with humility and understanding that I needed to check myself, and began just to sit in her apartment and watch this tenant leader, who had been the tenant leader since 1969 when the buildings were built, whose son was murdered in those buildings, in the lobby of one of those buildings. And she did not leave. Found out where she worked. She was working in the prosecutor's department. And she could have moved elsewhere, but she stuck it out. This local leader, like I know you know from being the Secretary of HUD, you've got so many of these powerful leaders in these communities that hold court and hold communities together by the force of their will and love. And what happened is she eventually let me just be her beast of burden. She would make me carry boxes and put up flyers, and I sort of apprenticeshiped with her, and the next thing you know, we're taking on the slumlord, and she pushes me into running for city council, and we have an 8-year friendship where I'm learning from her. The slumlord eventually gets convicted in federal court, and I end with this because this is what came out of the interviews. There's a painful chapter in there where she basically rescues me from being broken. And if you think about, we all want to take the safe way. Loving is taking a risk. If you love, you will get hurt. You will have your heart broken. America will break your heart. Your elected leaders will break your heart. But that's it's the hard way to go, but it's the rewarding way to go. And so it's some of my life's most broken times, which, by the way, is also when you break apart, it's when the light and the energy gets in and you resurrect. The Hindu faith, Shiva is the god of destruction, but so honored because it's those times where we get broken and destroyed that we can come back in even a stronger way. But at the end of this time, now she's passed away, I think I know the Miss Jones story, and I already know the name of the chapter. She's such an extraordinary soul. And I go back to interview people, and I track down to write this book, I track down the drug guys that were dealing drugs in front of the buildings to get their stories, the past security guard. I'm interviewing everybody I can find. And then I have these moments that just, to be honest with you, make me very emotional, because I begin to see the behind the veil that when I first arrived on the scene and I encountered this woman who had no patience from me, when I interviewed Miss Jean Wright, one of the other tent leaders, she goes, "You have the story all wrong. When this woman went to you, when you went to this woman and left her, she turned to all of us and she said right away, 'That's my son.'" And then when I had some very tense times with the guys dealing drugs in front of my building, and in fact, Jace Bradley, who let me use his name, one of the drug kingpins, one of the most amazing stories I ever heard, that I didn't know what was going on, how these guys ran their operation, he alleges to me that I was such a threat when I first arrived, they were so afraid that I would disrupt the drug raid, that he intervened. He said, "Yeah, man, I talked to him, the fellas," and I said, I intervened. And I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, I had to tell him not to shoot you." And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, no, it was just going to be in the leg. It was just going to be a warning shot. And I'm like, all right, man. But thank you. Then I asked him about Miss Jones. And while I'm feeling scared and intimidated by these guys and have some confrontations, they then report to me when I'm writing this book that Miss Jones was intervening with them, telling them to leave me alone. And the way she said it, one guy said this, when he said this in the interview, again, it choked me up. And he goes, "Corey, because she told me that you were family." And so I sit down here and in this synagogue, and I look up, and my friend Katie says, "Do you know what that says?" Now, I don't know how many of you know this. I'm the first, and I challenge any reporter. I haven't fact-checked this, but I challenge any reporter to check this. I am the first ever in the history of the globe, the first ever black Christian, black goy head of a Chabad house. Okay, I basically, thanks to a crazy rabbi in the best of ways, I mean this with love, in Oxford named Boteach, who made me the president of the Chabad house, president of the L'Chaim Society. So I know Hebrew, but I hadn't seen this phrase. Okay, he's like, that says, know who you stand before. And it's nice to hear this. Judaism is this great faith that understands the interconnectedness. There's a wonderful song sung during the High Holidays. You guys didn't know you were getting a Torah portion, did you not? This is why my way of sneaking it in, for those of you who only show up during the High Holidays. but there's a song sung during the High Holidays, Ki Beiti Beit Tefillah L'Chocho Amin. May my house be a house of prayer for many nations. This idea that in order to kum olam, heal the world, we need everybody, not just the Jews, but we need everybody. And this idea of knowing who you stand before. For those of us of faith, and I'm one of these people, before you talk to me about your religion, show it to me in how you treat other people. But when we stand before each other, as Miss Jones would say, who do we see? Even somebody that was arrogant and full of himself, as I was when I first showed up to Miss Jones, she saw, as she would say, the face of God. A person created in the image, she saw her son in me. And how often do we do that? And you know this because I entered the Senate, I got sworn in on the most auspicious day in the calendar, Halloween. And Mike Lee, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, if I began from seeing them as Tea Party or Libertarian or what have you, I would have lost opportunities. And I have my former chief of staff here and my current chief of staff here. They know there's things we got past just because of the strength of our human relationships with some of our colleagues. And so I have this debt I can't repay to the heroes I talk about, Miss Jones, Frank Hutchins. There are chapters about a waitress I met on my election day who is called, they call her Mama Tasha, and she works and makes $2.13 an hour, but this heroic figure in that IHOP. And we have the power, if we're willing to have that courageous empathy, that not only sees each other, knows who we stand before, but elevates each other, even if the person disagrees with us, annoys us, but no, we should know and have that faith, as I saw in Ms. Jones and others, that this person is worthy of love.
While we begin over here.
Could you zip your shirt so I don't see that text?
Texas. Before I ask my question, I just want to say real quick that knock on wood, of course, but it would be absolutely incredible if next year we were calling either of you Mr. Vice President.
There you go. It's all yours, Corey.
Do you hear what he said? The wisdom of the secretary is like, that's all yours, Corey. You take that question. So I'm on Twitter, which I may have an addictive relationship with social media. And somebody says to me, tweets to me, will you be the next VP? And I go, next VP? I'm already a vegan practitioner. And so to the head of the Humane Society, who is here, my dear brother, I will be a VP next year as I am a VP this year. That's what I will say. And I will say also that I commend you for your recognition in Secretary Castro of a guy who could be doing a lot of different things in this country and who does have...
And he will.
And he will. And I will tell you this. He'll do even more if he shaves his head.
So I'll be quick with my question, I promise. This is a bit of a pointed question, but I think it's important because both of you are rising stars in the party. And two quick disclaimers. I think that personally we're way better than the Republican Party when it comes to this, and obviously Secretary Clinton's candidacy is incredibly important in itself. But I've wondered over the last few years if we're doing enough as a Democratic Party to get more women into office and to support more women in office. And I think we're doing great. We're making an effort. But could we be doing better is what I wonder.
You made me take the last one. I'm letting you take this one.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think that we could start later this year in an important way. I tell this story. I have a daughter who's 6, about to turn 7, and when she was 3 or 4, one morning, my wife and I were getting her ready, and Good Morning America or the Today Show was on one of those shows, and an image of President Obama came up. And I said, oh, Karina, you know, there's a president. You could be president one day. And she said, oh, that's for boys. You know, like, literally. I mean, and, you know, as a parent, you start to wonder how, at such an early age, does your child have this impression? It makes you feel bad as a parent, but also what they're getting out there in the world. And so I agree with you that we need to do a better job of encouraging young girls to dream and go as far as they can in different fields, but including in leadership. And I think doing what we can, those of us who have made it into these positions, of reaching back and fostering a stronger pipeline of people getting into public service and women serving in different leadership positions. But you could write the same thing about companies and CEOs and folks in science and math and engineering and so forth. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Absolutely, but I mean, only 20%. I mean, I think we could be doing better, right? At least that our national officials, we could be going to state elections, local elections, and giving a lot of support to women candidates, which I don't think we're doing enough.
Right, and so, yes, and we're not doing enough, and I'll go to the next question, but I just want to affirm what you say. But my thing I always say is, when we see a problem, the first question we've got to ask, and I believe in this world we have one choice to make over and over again, to accept things as they are or take responsibility for changing them. And so this is something that we all should be doing something about. And how do we do something about it? There's a lot of different ways, a lot of different organizations that are focused on elevating women in elected office. And one of the things I've seen, I have this extraordinary colleague who's been one of my best mentors in the Senate, named Kirsten Gillibrand. And she deserves applause. And she is relentless. She started a PAC to support women. She does something that a lot of us Democrats don't like to do, get involved in primaries to support women. And she has pulled guys like me into the fray to really try to make this happen. But if you think the world is going to change unless you do, you're wrong. And so if this is an issue for everybody in this room, what even if it's just giving $1, I've seen with senators like Elizabeth Warren and even myself that small dollar contributions in the aggregate can add up to a lot. And I'll conclude by saying just my wish, which I know it's the Secretary's wish as well, is that I live in a two-family home in Newark, and my niece, my brother's daughter, lives below me. And she, too, she's 12 years old. And it's been a wake-up to me as a man to hang out with her and watch TV and suddenly see things through her eyes that are shocking to me. I thought I was an early Obama supporter in 08, but when I got into the campaign and I saw the things they were saying about Secretary Clinton, then Senator Clinton, the articles written about what she was wearing that didn't happen to President Obama, the articles that were written about tones and things like that just didn't happen. And so my dream for my niece is that by the time she enters high school, she only knows of two types of presidents. They're either a black guy or a woman. So when the white man becomes the president of the United States, that she says, that's strange. I didn't know they could be. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Booker,
what's your name? I'm sorry. And if you're not from Texas, please let me know that.
Of course. My name is Nathan, and I'm not from Texas.
Okay, good.
I'm a college student in the Washington, D.C. area, and your stories about Natasha Laurel sincerely and deeply helped to inspire me to continue to do my best to treat others with respect and dignity. And I mean that with utmost sincerity, and I wanted to thank you very much for that. And my question is as follows. What do you think is especially important for people today, especially for young people today, to understand about the importance of treating people with dignity and respect, and why?
First of all, I thank you for your question, and not being from Texas. very quickly, a lot of people ask me about what's my advice for other people. And I didn't want to write a book that stood up and spouted off advice for other folks in that way. I wanted to talk about where I failed, where I came up short, where I got my comeuppance. And there's one section that I ended up not writing about that really is reflected in something that I tweet out all the time and say to my friends, which is, all quotes about kindness. You know, I think that we should be kind to unkind people because they really need it. I think we should be kind to each other because we're all more fragile than we let on. And when I worked I was a teenager and I started working at Stanford at a peer counseling center, crisis counseling center. And it was almost like the veil had been revealed from me. And I took questions about depression, took calls about eating disorders. We had calls about sexual assault. I just couldn't believe on this happy place of Stanford that so many issues were going on right in front of us. And yet, a lot of times I would find from these counseling sessions that people feel like they're alone and isolated amidst all of this. And so there's a man in there in the book another very moving leader of mine named Frank Hutchins. And the title of the chapter is I See You. And he taught me this remark, me, and I was impatient and brash and really desirous of getting to the goal or winning the fight. And he was one of these people that told me to slow down in life and begin to see people and take time, as I said earlier, to extend empathy. And so I don't know what to tell young people. I actually, and I know the Secretary feels this way, when I hang out with millennials or the generation next to come up, I don't know, have we named for them yet?
The generation after millennials?
Is that the name? G
yeah.
after M?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm blown away by millennials in our country and young folks in our country, they tend to inspire me. And so my only thing, my only advice, if I can be so bold to give advice to anyone, it's to fiercely live your authentic spirit. And if you want to reach out to somebody, a lot of times we don't because we feel inhibited for some reason. But we weren't meant to be stoic and removed people. We really were, I believe, are called to greater and greater levels of love. In fact, I'll tell you this. I get annoyed, and this is going to be a terrible clip that's going to be used on YouTube to sink my future elections, but I'm going to say something. I'm sick
of... What are you running for, by the way? That's what we're going to know. Since you brought it up.
Listen, Castro, you don't want to go down that road. Because two can play at that game. My term goes until 2020. You are going to be out of office in about... So the bad quote is this. I'm tired of people preaching tolerance. I'm tired of it. As if that's some kind of noble state of being to tolerate other people. Tolerance to me is a cynical or lazy state of being that says, I'm just going to stomach your right to be different. And if you disappear off the face of the earth, I'm no worse off or better off. We should be striving to move as a country beyond tolerance to love and to see that everybody has worth and everybody has value. And I'm hoping that that as the people that I meet, in even in D.C., even in my travels in the halls of Congress, is that there is a natural human desire to love and to show kindness and to extend that. And I hope that in our civic space where we celebrate the kind of things we're seeing in presidential debates and seem to elevate people for the kind of punches that they throw, that I'm hoping that we can begin in our civic culture to celebrate those people who reach out, those people who extend themselves, those people who embrace others, those people who demonstrate that I'm not a being created to tolerate another. I'm a being that was created to love another.
Good evening, Senator Booker. I know you're very passionate about ending mass incarceration, and I wanted to ask about private prisons. We talk a lot about how private prisons, you know, incentivize locking people up, and I wondered if you have any opinions on how the private sector can be used instead to give people jobs and help end mass incarceration.
Yeah, one on private prisons, I'm against them. And please know that the majority of people that... The biggest private prisons in our country are not for American citizens. It's what we do with immigrants and their horrific environments, where we could do it differently. We don't even have to detain the people. There's a lot of folks who aren't even flight risks, but yet we're sticking them in institutions where there's no accountability. When you enter a profit margin, a profit incentive into the realm of physical incarceration. It creates perverse outcomes, and I think it undermines our value system as a country. And so I want to take another step, though, because you bring up mass incarceration as a whole, which is I'm very passionate about it, because I don't believe that the country that celebrates freedom and liberty should be a nation that has only 5% of the globe's population, but one out of every four imprisoned people on the planet Earth are here in America. And worse than that, the overwhelming number of people we incarcerate. In fact, there's more people today incarcerated for nonviolent offenses than all the people that were incarcerated in the 1970s. That we are a nation that incarcerates people for nonviolent offenses, and we feast upon the most vulnerable of our citizenry. Our jails and our prisons are full of the poor, the mentally ill, the addicted, and minorities. And it violates all of our values. And when I say all of our values, the entire political spectrum, from fiscal conservatives, because we're wasting trillions of dollars that other countries aren't spending on prisons. In fact, while other countries were building high-speed rail, expanding broadband, we were disinvesting in infrastructure in this country, except for one area. We were building a new prison every 10 to 12 days. And so it violates our values on when it comes to race issues. There's no difference between Latinos, blacks, and whites for using drugs or dealing drugs. But if you're a minority in this country and live in a community like Newark or Detroit, you have a whole different type of drug war there. Nobody's stopping and frisking Stanford students on their way home from a party. And if they did, and our college president hates when I say this, but they would find a lot of folk with drugs. Remember, the last two presidents have admitted to felonies that people today are in jail for and having to surrender their liberty. And so blacks are about 3.7 times more likely than whites to be arrested for drugs. Latinos are twice as likely. And I can go on and on and on about this, but I want to bring it to the simple point of saying this. We live with this cancer on our society that's hurting every American. We're now at a point where one out of three American adults has an arrest record. We're hurting our economy, our economic growth. We're hurting the next generation of children, because children of incarcerated adults have terrible outcomes. It's such a crisis that even Sesame Street is now doing programming. Go home and put Sesame Street, children of incarcerated adults, and you'll see their programming for those kids. We are transforming the culture of this country, creating a new Jim Crow, creating deeper levels of poverty. Vanderbilt says we have 20% less poverty if our incarceration rates were the same as other countries. This is a sin, it is a cancer, and we need to join hands as a nation and say enough is enough. We will transform this reality.
To hear you talk about trauma on the radio today on Diane Reen. We know what complex trauma does to the brain insofar as daily functioning. I'm a social worker at a domestic and sexual violence agency, so I work with clients in an emergency shelter. And unfortunately, due to funding streams, rapid rehousing, homeless prevention, we have to house them really quickly before they deal with the impact of their trauma, often that's been going on the course of their lifetime. So what I was hoping to ask you is, how can we promote scientific literacy amongst legislators so that we can have better policies that get to the root of these problems and better address them? Thank you.
I love you for your question, because this is sort of a new realization for me about now the understanding and the science of understanding what trauma does to young people. And please understand, for women especially, we have a criminal justice system that punishes women for experiencing trauma. There is a trauma or sexual assault to prison pipeline that is dramatic and, again, such a violation of our values as a people. But what we're seeing now is childhood trauma is at the core of a lot of the challenges. When I was first mayor, and I went to meet with the FBI director, the special agent in charge of my region, and we were talking about crime, violence, all this stuff, and I said, well, how do we solve this problem? I was mayor, again, brash, we're going to snap our fingers, solve some problems. He's like, what do you mean, solve the problem? He goes, we're law enforcement. We don't solve the problem. We treat the symptom of the problem. And so a lot of the things we are trying to solve with prisons need to be solved with mental health. They need to be care with drug treatment care, with counseling, with recognizing people in need before it becomes, as Frederick Douglass says, it's easier to raise strong children than to heal broken men. And so this is a new consciousness that's beginning to rise in our country. Brian Stevenson, who I recommend, in fact, I was so happy today, my publisher showed me that, you know, how Amazon, people who bought this book, bought this book. And I was really worried. I was like freaking out, like, people who bought this book also bought Donald Trump's book. I didn't know where it would be, you know. So, but it was Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, popped up, and he is one of the more powerful forces of good on the planet Earth, in my opinion. It should be up for the Nobel Peace Prize. And he says rightfully that we live in a country where you're treated better if you're rich and guilty than poor and innocent. But he and I, the last time we were together speaking together, he just couldn't stop talking to me about how we've got to start turning our public policy and our health initiatives onto issues of trauma. And if we did that, we would reduce violence in this country dramatically. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you.
We have time for two more questions.
What's that?
Two more questions.
All right.
We're two branches of government, dude. I mean,
that's right.
We're going to let her to tell us two. I think we should say three.
As long as you give me the money to keep going, I can keep going.
I say we say three questions and let them pry these microphones out of our hands.
So three more questions.
Three more. We're strong, man. Yeah. We'll never be invited back.
You got the energy of the Democratic Party here, the youthful energy of the Democratic Party.
We're not going to silence your voices. Speed round. Which way are you going to go? You're going to go one, two, three?
Once, two, and then back there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi. Right. My name is Francesca Salazar, and I'm not from Texas. I lived in San Antonio. I'm originally from New Mexico. So.
Wait, you're not from Texas, but you're from San Antonio.
I lived
what
in
is
San
she trying
Anto-
to say about your Texas?
I didn't hear that, yeah.
I lived in San Antonio.
You lived in San Antonio. All right.
Who was the best mayor ever of San Antonio?
Right here. My question is this. Our country is so divided, and I sit amongst my fellow veterans, and we can't even agree. We can't even talk about politics without an argument incurring. What can we do to help, as individuals, help heal our country to come to a middle ground? Because we know, as you know, united we stand, divided we fall.
You want to try that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I think it's, you know, the really at the heart of the book. I mean, to me, the most instructive thing about my time in public service was being a mayor in a nonpartisan system. And I remember when I was mayor, campaigning for mayor, we would go and we would knock on everybody's door. You know, you had your block walking lists, and regardless of whether they were a Democrat or Republican, if they had only voted for Republicans, maybe you might not go there. But generally, we would knock on everybody's door and talk to folks about sidewalks and fixing the roads and picking up the garbage and doing economic development. And I think somehow in our system, in our partisan system, we have to figure out a way to be able to introduce that those common issues, the common interests that we have, that you really do see a lot more, you know, when you serve as a mayor or in some local capacity where people just care about you getting something done. And it's not as ideological. That's not the lens that they look at you through first. And I don't think that there's any easy answer to that, but you know, institutions and folks in public service and citizen groups that are geared toward that, I think, can only help us get closer, you know, to a time when this group of folks isn't just watching these TV shows or this network, and these are watching another one, and these politicians are speaking to one group, and these are speaking to another. I do think that we can get past this phase. I think it's a phase, but it's going to take a staking out of the common interests that we have as Americans and a way to summon a common national identity again, which has become harder over time.
Thank you. That's excellent.
Thank you. Okay.
My question's about the primary cycle this time. If you looked at the two parties' candidates, you would think that the party that represented values of diversity might be the Republicans, based on the candidates who are running in their backgrounds. You have children of immigrants. You have people from a variety of ethnic, racial backgrounds, occupational diversity. And then on the Democratic side, we don't see any of that diversity. And yet, we know there are talented young leaders in the Democratic Party. How have we come to that point?
Okay. I chose wrong.
Yeah, you thought you got off the hook.
Look, I've heard Republicans bandy this about, oh, we're the bigger party of diversity. Look at our presidential candidates versus your presidential candidates. I look at conventions and the people who fill convention halls. And when I look at the Republican convention, it's just not as nearly as diverse as I look at the Democratic Party. And by the way, I'm not saying that one party's that I don't want to try to cast aspersions on the Republican Party. That's not why I'm here tonight. I just simply want to say that we as a country have a rich, deep diversity that's not represented in our politics. And we have a rich, deep gender diversity, clearly, that's not represented in our politics. And as Secretary Castro said, it ain't just politics. It's a lot of sectors of our life, and we all need to be agents of dealing with that on areas big and small. Look, when I came to Washington, all this talk about Wall Street and all this, so I came here, and I don't know if you all know this, but the federal government manages pensions. Who manages the federal government's pensions? Well, in Texas and New Jersey, there are diverse pension programs that make sure that those billions of dollars being managed by our two states, that some of that money is being invested with diverse
managers, what they call emerging managers, women and minorities. Now, by the way, Barclays Bank did an analysis of that area of the finance industry and found out that those diverse managers actually have a better performance than the other ones. So I'm coming down to Washington, D.C., see the example in a blue state like New Jersey, and see the example in a future blue state like Texas. And I asked the question. We are the biggest pension fund managers in America, the federal government. How many, what percentage of the dollars that we have is being managed by diverse emerging managers? This is Washington, D.C. I'm just a new guy. And I asked the question. Zero. Not $1. And so I know when it comes to wealth creation and opportunity that you have to be a hawk on it everywhere. The Senate itself, staffers in the Senate, it's a, not a diverse place. Senate Page program, not nearly representative in its diversity. And so I see that just in my world because I look for it all the time. But what about you and where you live? You, where you work? Are you calling the question? And this is the problem we often make is that I do this, so I'm blaming myself, is I get caught up sometimes in a state of sedentary agitation. When I'm upset about everything I'm seeing in the world that's wrong, and I stand there and my friend from Stanford, Rachel Maddow, gets me so upset because she's pointing out all this injustice and I want to take off my size 14s and throw it at the TV. That's wrong. And then I realize, well, wait a minute, how can I complain about the world if I'm not finding something in my own realm which I can do? Now, there's not a person in this room that thinks that we are doing a great job with juvenile violence because it's horrific, the number of children that are dying every single day by murder. And we have the courage to deplore that situation. But what if I told everybody here there's an easy way to dramatically cut juvenile violence, an easy way? You people would be like, oh my gosh, what is the wisdom Corey is going to speak as he stands before the ark and with the Torah at his back? Speak to us, O Corey, O Tower of Booker. And it's not some genius. We know the answers because we have the data. If you went to every fourth grade teacher in America and tell us the kids you're most worried about getting in trouble, they are very predictive about knowing a lot of the kids that might have problems. And if you took those at-risk children or some other measure of selecting them and made sure everyone had a mentor, mentoring, the data is clear. Quality mentoring programs drive down the rates of juvenile crime, drive up the rates of student success, drive down the rates of early unsafe sex practices. You want to stop abortions or teen pregnancies. It's an easy bipartisan way. Nobody's going to argue about mentoring. But this is the problem. It takes only 4 hours a month to be a mentor. 4 hours, the amount of time we spend watching our favorite TV show. I don't know. I think in Texas it might be Jerseylicious or Real Housewives of New Jersey. But
they're the Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore. The Snooki is big in Texas. 4 hours a month. But we don't do it. There are thousands and thousands of children right now today on waiting lists, coast to coast in America, through programs like Big Brother and Big Sister, but we can't find people to mentor. You may not be able to change the world, but you could save somebody's world. I'm a busy guy. I'm on a book tour. I saw my little mentee yesterday. And so what I'm saying is we all have this power that we're not using to change the very problems that we're talking about. And it's a problem of collective action. And I know this is the last question, but I'll give you one little more vignette. I was in mayor of the city of Newark in 2008. And I go to vote in November of 2008. And if you are in a majority-minority city, in November of 2008, with 85% blacks and Latinos, that is, I mean, I think all over the country was exciting, but when I went to vote, it was like, oh my God, there's lines around the building of my, I've never seen lines in that, and this is amazing. It was everybody was lining up in Newark to vote for Barack Obama. And I get to the end of the line, and this is the difference between Jersey and Texas. They're really genteel. The Southern gentility is, and the Texas gentility is great. He's the mayor. He goes up. People like, I was with him in San Antonio. Hi, mayor. They're all polite. It's just nice. We keep it real in Newark. I walk up to the end of the line in Jersey, and the woman in the line doesn't say to me, hello, mayor, it's good to see you. I even have a security officer next to me. The woman looks at me and says, don't you think you're cutting in line now? I don't care who you are. You ain't special. You're going to wait just like the rest of us. And I'm the mayor. I look at this woman and I go, yes, ma'am. hour of line waiting, get in, and there's a commotion going on. Somebody's screaming at the table because her name is not in the book. They're not going to let her vote. She's screaming, if you don't let me vote, I'm not leaving here until I vote for Barack Obama. And I walk in, and I'm a person of authority. This controversy going on. Everybody stops. The mayor's in the room. They look to me for help. The poll worker, please hug poll workers because it's the hardest job in America. You don't get paid. It's like terrible. The Department of Labor, we should call Perez. Do something about this. And this woman looks at me, everyone's looking at me for help, but I am a politician. I know how to play to a crowd. So instead of taking control of the situation, making sure everybody's safe, I add to the problem by yelling, she's not leaving here until she votes for Barack Obama. 1 year later, it is 2009, and New Jersey's having a gubernatorial election. There's a guy, our incumbent governor, John Corzine, is running against a guy that you guys probably have never heard of. And I go to vote, and there's no line. And I walk right in, and I do hug the poll worker because she looks lonely. And then the election results come in, and Chris Christie wins. And Chris Christie has different priorities than me, and he cuts Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood hours get shut down. Planned Parenthood's closed. He says he wasn't going to raise taxes, but he cut the earned income tax credit, which raised taxes on poor people in my city who work full-time jobs and barely stay in their housing. Asthma is the number one reason in America why kids miss school, and he pulls out of the regional greenhouse gas agreements. He cuts funding to cities. Most big cities in New Jersey were cutting police force. And then people come to me and say, what are they doing to us? What are they doing to us? And I'm saying, doing to us, if cities like Newark, Trenton, Camden just had 75% of the turnout they did last year, nobody in America would know who Chris Christie is. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back to what King said. He said, what we will have to repent for in this day and age is not the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, but the appalling silence and indifference of the good people. And so... question.
You're on a roll, man.
Just no, this is where, this is like, this is now where we're on that extended time, and all the people in this wonderful synagogue of peace and love are looking at us like, these two jerks.
These folks need to go to dinner or something here, man.
That's a lot of pressure on you for the last question.
I know. Well, I'll try to end it on a happy note.
Okay.
How about that? Well, I'm going to ask you a personal question, Senator.
A
personal question. I know you mentioned it briefly, but I want to ask you about your veganism. I know it's becoming much, much more mainstream than it used to be. In fact, I hear there's even a new vegetarian collective being formed here at Six and I. And so I guess my question in particular is, now that we have a U.S. vegan senator, what do you think the next milestone is for veganism?
What do I think for what?
The next milestone is for veganism in the U.S.
The next milestone is we will put a vegan person on the moon! So I actually write about this in my book, and a foreshadowing, because I've got the book right now, is Wayne Pacelli, who's the head of the Municipal, is writing a book that's amazing. And I get a chance to interview you, right, in Washington, D.C., and boy, you're going to have a tough night. look, I write about it in this book that this moment where it's election day for me to the United States Senate for a full six-year term, and I feel that I've been a vegetarian since 1992, but I'm going to make the move to be vegan, but I'm going to go out in style. And so I go to the IHOP, which if you want to have your last non-vegan meal, and I sit down and I order enough carbohydrates to feed the offensive line of the New York Giants for a month. Pumpkin pancakes, stuffed French toast, cheese eggs. I'm just going to town. And that's when I met the woman that this chapter is about, a woman named Natasha Laurel, who comes to me, and again, you don't realize how your lives are interwoven into it. But right at the beginning of the chapter, I try to explain why am I a vegan. And I just think that all of us, Socrates says that, talks about the unexamined life. And I don't think we should preach to each other. I think that the best thing that people have done for me, who are gentle and loving to me, just call on me to live your best self. When my parents were tough on me, they would, if I did something wrong, they would not say that you're dumb or you're this. They would say, this is not who you are. How could you behave this way? And so I want to think about, and I'm not living life consistently with my values. I want to admit that right now. I am definitely not living my life inconsistent with my beliefs. And I haven't met the person, except for maybe the Pope did come to Washington, but I have not met the person yet who is living life in perfect consistency. And often it's because we choose, remember, everything's a choice, whether we consciously are making it or not, to not know what the realities are that we're engaged in. Now, the example I often give is the most powerful vote that Americans have often in this consumer society is what we do with our dollars, because every day we're endorsing something that we may not know. Where is this suit made? Who made it? How were they paid? Does the suit reflect my value system? Where do the eggs come that I ate? Is it reflecting my values? And so what I've just tried to do a little bit every year is, especially around the end of a year, is to think to myself, what am I doing to live my highest self? What am I doing to live with the greatest authenticity, or more importantly, the greatest integrity? And I'll end with this. And you know, I think we all can be harder on ourselves than anybody else can. And I'm one of those people that beats up on myself a lot. And I think I say in the book that I learned in my life that the most important conversations you have every day are the conversations you have with yourself. And because every moment of your life, as I said earlier, you have a choice to make about what truth are you going to tell to the world. Are you going to be loyal to your truth? Are you going to live your light and your brilliance? Or are you going to do something that diminishes it? And so for me, my father would say, son, there's two ways to go through life. You can go through life as a thermometer or a thermostat. A thermostat is just reflects the world around you. If the world is doing, everybody in the world is doing this, I'm doing that. If the world's getting hot, I'm getting hot. If you're on an airplane and people are frustrated and pushing and shoving, I'm going to be frustrated and all that. But a thermostat is one of those people that sets the temperature, that decides that I'm not going to surrender to the circumstances around me. I'm going to be somebody that dares to be different and to tell my truth every day. Now, that's incredibly hard. And I end with the way I end the chapter on Miss Jones, when it's so nice to say that you, at the end of a year, set your goals, and then to enter the combat of everyday life and not pay attention to a lot of those little things. And so I end this chapter with Miss Jones about her trying to remind me that hope is not something that exists in the abstract. It is a response. It is a response to despair. It is a response to injustice. Even if it's you yourself that have done something wrong, to be able to pick yourself up and live with hope. And on one of the lowest moments, and I won't go into this, but one of the lowest moments of my life, when I was completely broken, a very powerful moment is when Miss Jones hugs me and gives me perhaps the greatest advice she gave me. And this is a woman you'll see through the two chapters of this book that would pop into my life at the right time with the right message. And this last message she gave me that I hope that all of us in this room try, and I don't mean this in a religious way. I don't care if you're an atheist or a Christian evangelical. I mean this in the way of staying true to your beliefs and your ideals. And I walked to this woman across the courtyard of Brick Towers, broken, crying the night before for circumstances that if you choose to read about, you can. And Miss Jones sees me, and she says no words. She opens up her arms. It was early in the morning. She died with only two people in the courtyard. And I know exactly what she wants me to do, and I'm so happy. So she opens up her arms. I walk over. I'm so much bigger than her. But it's one of those moments we've all had as adults where you just feel like a child. And I curl up in her arms, and she's hugging me. And then she says two words that made me just start crying on her shoulder. She just says these two words over and over again. And and it's the words I've repeated to myself on so many days. Days in the Senate when I get frustrated and angry, or days where I disappoint myself and I make bad mistakes and say something stupid or do something dumb. And she said these two words over and over again. Stay faithful, stay faithful. Stay faithful, stay faithful. May we all stay faithful in our pursuit of our best light and our best truth, and especially as people who are bonded together, brothers and sisters in the spirit, may we stay faithful to one another. And if we do that, I'm telling you right now, as human history and American histories in particular, a perpetual testimony to the achievement of the impossible, if we stay faithful together, we will achieve impossible things again for our country. So thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.